Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where we have a discussion on the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, which I'm told is next Monday. And we have three speakers tonight. Hugh Harley is the Australia and Asia Financial Services Leader at PwC. He's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Business at the University of Sydney. Anya Pachansky, a graduate in law at Sydney University, currently a lawyer at the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. And Tim Wilson, making a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here in this room not so long ago, and of course he's the Human Rights Commissioner. So we're going to go with Hugh Harley, Anya Pachansky, Tim Wilson, and then we'll come to the questions and discussion. And the topic is the legacy of Magna Carta, 800 years on. Hugh Harley.
Thanks very much, Gerard. Good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here to talk about the legacy of the Magna Carta. And for me, I'm effectively a banker by profession, so this has really been a hobby and a labour of love for me. I've spent the last 18 months, I've always been intrigued by the Magna Carta, and I thought I'd, you know, set myself the task of coming to grips with it. So in the 15 minutes allocated to me, I thought I'd focus on a couple of surprises that I've had along the way, and then build up to some reflections on the legacy. Probably the first surprise is that when I started off this work, I thought that I was going to find the era of the Magna Carta was very much a feudal England, a static and unchanging England, whereas I've pretty well concluded exactly the opposite. Now, an easy place to start with that is actually technology. You know, the era of the 1100s and the 1200s was actually quite a time of quite a lot of technology change. Doesn't necessarily seem large by today's standards, but in the context of the day, it definitely was. For instance, in agriculture, you know, the horse was used for ploughing for the first time, roughly twice as effective as oxen. You know, we think in energy, windmills. Few of us know that the windmill was invented globally in England, southern England, in 1185. Coal had been used for a long time for heating, but it was only in the 1220s, for instance, that coal was used for a commercial purpose for the first time. So when you go to London and you see, for instance, Sea Coal Lane or Lime Burners Lane, that they literally date to 1226. The effectiveness of water power was improved a lot. So for the first time, the camshaft was used, and that revolutionised the production of wool cloth. Even modern banking really originated in this era. For instance, the first confirmed use of the word capital, dates to 1211. And that's why I think that authors like Braudel and Gimpel are exactly right to regard that era as the first industrial revolution. And not surprisingly, at the same time, with that rapid industrialisation and technology change, it was actually a period of quite strong growth. So, for instance, you know, the improvement in agriculture, we're seeing the population of England more or less double over the 150 years or so up to the Magna Carta. You saw a rapid growth in urbanisation. In fact, the most rapid growth in the establishment of new towns up until the 1700s. What then was particularly interesting is that, to me, it's not just this pace of economic change and technology change, but actually when you scratch below the surface, the market relations were much more developed than we guess, much more than just a feudal society. In part, then, of course, was because urbanisation was growing quickly. And so the townspeople had to rely on their commercial wits all the time. But again, you know, even the common law, there was the expression, the town air makes you free. Now, there was an economic aspect of that. But if a serf escaped and managed to live within the bounds of one of the boroughs for a year and a day, he was made a free man. Likewise, the common law actually gave townspeople much more liberty in their discretion about how they made wills than others. And that was all about giving townspeople more incentive to create wealth in the first place. Then the real kicker, I think, some tremendous work by the economic historian Alan Macfarlane, who has estimated that by at least the 1250s, nearly half the population, one way or the other, was involved in either wage labour or profit-making enterprises. And the essence of that was actually the big land owners preferred to the flexibility and the greater productivity that came with wage labour, a much higher percentage than people had expected. And when you added on the fact that we were going through a substantial period of industrialisation, there was actually much more scope for people to be able to use the poor seasons or the downtime, the seasonal quiet times, to be able to produce effectively quasi-manufactured goods. And so there was more trade flowing from that. And for instance, or consistent with that, just as you see the rapid growth in urbanisation at the time, you also see the rapid growth in market days as well. And so Macfarlane summarises his conclusions in this way. The majority of ordinary people in England from at least the 13th century were rampant individualists, highly mobile, both individually and socially, economic rational, market-oriented and acquisitive, egocentric in kinship and social life. And indeed, as one English writer of the day said, no one who wants to make money ever need die poor. What I think is particularly interesting is that the same conclusions can't be taken from continental Europe. And as a result, I've really come to the conclusion, and this in a sense is the central thesis of Danziger's and Gillingham's great book 1215, that effectively the Magna Carta was really the product, not just the producer of freedoms, but actually the product of a society trying to come to grips with both the privileges and freedoms of the privileges and problems of quite extensive economic freedoms. And then if we're thinking about legacy and the big picture history themes here, it seems to me that's an intriguing insight. You know, if England was running such a more liberal and economically free environment back then, perhaps that's a hint actually about why the ultimately English society took off and led the world into the economic modern world. I'll come back to that theme in a moment, but let me go to a second surprise. And that is that great theme in history about a few good men. I mean, we're inclined, I think we're all brought up when we think of the Magna Carta, to actually think about bad men. Bad King John and the greedy barons. The reality, to some extent that's true. But there are a couple of really important and critically good men that I think is key to the story. The first is Stephen Langton, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time. And it was actually he who conceived the idea of dealing with the barons' long list of very real grievances in terms of actually a negotiated settlement that was all around the rights and obligations on a legal basis. Now, the fact that he was able to persuade the barons of this less than 50 years after the very, very origins of the common law is clearly an extraordinary achievement and something that I'm not sure always gets enough credit. But the other point, of course, the fact he could, the fact that barons were prepared to go along with that, is of course itself another pointer to the fact that this we're actually dealing with quite a sophisticated society. The other hero, and I think probably the greatest hero of all in this story in many ways, is William Marshall. Now, William Marshall was a baron, but he was actually a baron who was loyal to King John all the way through 1215. He then got thrust in the limelight when King John died unexpectedly in October 1216. And the new king, Henry the Third, was only nine, and William Marshall became the regent. Now, despite the fact that he had supported the king against the barons all that time, effectively the very first thing he did after being made regent was to reissue the Magna Carta, slightly revised, but essentially the same. And again, I think that tells us that by then people had realised that the combination, the 63 clauses taken together, all made a fair bit of economic sense. But what's even more interesting than that, in a sense, is that 12 months later, William Marshall reissued the Magna Carta, but this time with a companion, the Forest Charter. And the point about this is that one of the great economic issues of the time, one of the great issues of the time, was the access of the common man to the king's forests, obviously a core source of resources. And that had been one of the contested issues around the negotiations of the Magna Carta. It had actually been an issue that the king had won. He got away with much less than the barons had wanted at the time. So what did William Marshall do with the Forest Charter? He actually moved the deal on the forests much closer, effectively right in line with what the barons had wanted in 1215. And indeed, in some way, I mean, this again comes back to a source of economic freedom, because you're effectively giving the ordinary man access to the forest in a way that some have compared to the sort not seen again until the 1700s. Another interesting element in terms of this constant link we see in the history of the early history of the Magna Carta between economic freedoms and the Magna Carta itself. The other interesting thing is that because this issue of afforestation remained contested for the next 100 years, it was actually one of the key reasons why the Magna Carta kept on getting affirmed and actually kept the issue of the Magna Carta alive in that critical century. It's one of the reasons why it survived through the 1200s, and then by 1314, the courts were beginning to rely on it as legal precedent, and in a sense, the rest is history. So let me then bring us closer to today. And I think there's an obvious point about so many of the issues of the era of Magna Carta having such an important echo today. Now, an obvious one, which I won't repeat, is this question of the extensive market relations. Another obvious one, and frankly a less happy one, is to remind us this was also the era of the peak of the Crusades. And of course, you know, we can think about the conflict that we see across the world today. And I hardly need to mention the critical importance of the rule of law today and the Magna Carta's role in that. A more interesting one, in a sense, or a less obvious one, is this whole question the question of elections. One of the last things King John did before conceding to the barons in June of 1215 was in May 1215 agreed that the City of London could elect their own mayor for the first time. Now, this wasn't recorded in the Magna Carta, but it was the basis of that. Now, I'm happy to stand corrected, but I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that this is the first instance of a ruling monarch actually conceding to giving some power away through election. And I think, you know, in terms of legacy, you know, we can sense that as an important step in the long quest towards democracy. Sort of related to that, some have argued that the final clauses of the Magna Carta, which set up a commission or council of barons to oversee the Magna Carta, is a forerunner of modern parliaments. I personally think that's probably a step too far. I think Churchill's much closer when he describes the provisions of Oxford in 1258 and the provisions of Winchester in 1259 as the right place to start. But the point I want to make is that within that 100 years, from the beginning of the common law in the 1160s, the Magna Carta in 1215, elections of at least of London mayors in 1215, and then, you know, those first early steps towards Parliament, an extraordinary period of change. And it's also worth noting that the whole concept of the modern corporation dates to the late 1100s, right? The idea of the body corporate was set up precisely as a negotiating tool for London and other boroughs to actually be able to purchase rights and privileges and freedoms from the monarch itself. And from there, it's evolved into the concept of the modern corporation today. And then let me end up on this point. I started off talking about technology and the sense of the first industrial revolution and the fact that was clearly associated with profound institutional change. Of course, we know exactly the same was true for the industrial revolution we're more familiar with, the 1700s and 1800s. But it seems to me that gives next Monday's 800th anniversary particular poignance, in that, you know, obviously the fact that Magna Carta has survived for 800 years, it's been so influential, you know, that's a great achievement by any measure. But the fact that that here now we're living through such profound technology change seems to me to give a special importance to that 800th anniversary. Certainly for me, you know, I think that the digital revolution that we're living through is going to be every bit as significant as the coal and steam revolution of the 1700s and 1800s. You know, and if you link that to the Magna Carta was all about the rule of law. In a sense, that's the start of trust in modern society. And what we're seeing with the digital revolution, I think, is absolutely a change in how trust and hence economic value is created in modern society. For the first time, all of us as individuals can actually have our own fact-based measures of trust accessible not just to corporations or governments, institutions, but actually to other individuals. You know, this is Airbnb is a classic example of this. This has never happened before. The advanced peer-to-peer lenders are just the same. And so, you know, here we are at a time where the very essence of trust and the way it's measured and the way it's generated in society is changing. And you know, personally, I think, as I said a moment ago, this is going to be very profound. I mean, as the Bank of England argued last year, this is a bit closer to my own core interests, for more than 800 years, depositing and lending were the preserve of the high street banks. Yet we may be about to enter an era where banking too becomes virtual. And so this, you know, this is this point, I think, about the coincidence between 800 years of Magna Carta and the change of trust. You know, and I personally think that we're going to see the same sort of frictions that we saw in each of those two eras I've mentioned, the 1100s and 1200s, the 1700s and 1800s, inevitably create the sorts of pressures that's going to require actually quite profound rethinking of our institutional frameworks. And I think in this, the good news is definitely that by recognising that actually, you know, the common view is that there was some great revolution in the 1700s and 1800s, and we entered a period of a break from the past, if you like. Actually, I think when you understand the story of Magna Carta, really we've been on an evolution now for more, not 200 to 300 years, more like 800 to 900 years. And I think when we see it in that context, we've got a much better chance of preserving those liberties that were fundamental to the Magna Carta, but which I think we'd all agree are so valuable to ourselves today. Thanks very much.
Now we go with Anya Pachansky. Anya.
So the Magna Carta is a founding myth, and it's the founding ones, of course, that make for the best sport. But we also have a duty to view our heritage with a clear eye. Adulation without analysis has never set history on a positive course. Australians have the right to vote, the right to communicate freely about politics, freedom from discrimination based on sex, race or religion, and the right to a presumption of innocence. These are some of the foundational rights of our democracy. The Magna Carta is not the guarantor of these rights. In fact, as we will see, none of the rights and freedoms which we exercise in Australia today arise from or are protected by the Magna Carta. That is not to say that the Magna Carta is not a significant document, a milestone in the development of our system of law and indeed in our conception of governance. There is, however, a crucial and frequently neglected distinction between the symbolic importance of the Great Charter and its true legal effect. The Magna Carta is very weak law in Australia, a ghost of a law, or really more like a reanimated corpse, because the Magna Carta is on the statute books in Australia. It's just that it's there the way that Banjo Patterson is on the $10 note. He brings noble thoughts to mind, but he's not the reason you can buy a sandwich. England, evidently with enough other sources of noble sentiments, began repealing the Magna Carta in 1828. Over 140 years, it was whittled down to just three clauses. Chapter 1, pertaining to the Church of England's freedom. Chapter 9, maintaining the liberties of the City of London. And the famous Chapter 29, to which we will return. Australian states have taken two different approaches to their legacy of imperial legislation. Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, and the ACT passed Imperial Acts legislation in the 20th century, repealing and regularising the imperial legislation which entered Australia upon colonisation. These jurisdictions have only kept Chapter 29 on the books. Western Australia, South Australia, the Northern Territory, and Tasmania didn't pass such legislation. They technically still have the entire Magna Carta on the books, minus Chapter 26, which was repealed before it could cross to Australia. Even so, the statute books are clearly not the source of the Magna Carta's significance. By 1922, the provisions of the Magna Carta were said to have really very little practical effect. The Imperial Acts legislation only kept Chapter 29 in the books because of what was described at the time as its sentimental value. Its presence among the statutes of other states is less nostalgia than mere oversight. Moreover, as a statute, the Magna Carta is not entitled to any special authority. The doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, another foundational piece of common law, holds that Parliament is always competent, and that's a technical term, not an adjective here, I assure you, to pass legislation which overrides past legislation. A new law overrides an old law to the extent of inconsistency on the same subject, and a specific law overrides a more general law. Being the oldest and most general statute around, it's no surprise that the Magna Carta has been superseded. All this is reflected by the courts, who treat it with a veneration but a marked reluctance to apply the Charter in actual cases. Where the Magna Carta is cited, it's usually in support of a decision which has already been reached by way of the evidence and the state of contemporary law. Yet the Magna Carta is frequently invoked as the source of at least four monumental common law rights: habeas corpus, or the freedom from unlawful imprisonment, trial by jury, the right to a speedy trial, and due process of law. The key source of these riches is Chapter 29, which reads, "No free man is to be taken or imprisoned or disseized of his free tenement or of his liberties or free customs, or outlawed or exiled or in any way ruined, nor will we go against such a man or send against him save by lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. To no one will we sell or deny or delay the right or justice." Snappy. In fact, habeas corpus both pre- and post-dates the Magna Carta. Writs with similar effect were in use from the 12th century. While the use of the writ of habeas corpus to ensure to free a prisoner from unjust detention didn't come about until much later, the link between Magna Carta and habeas corpus wasn't made until Darnell's case in 1628. In New South Wales, law, habeas corpus is protected by Section 69 of the Supreme Court Act, which permits the court to apply the writ as it was codified in the Habeas Corpus Acts of 1640 and 1679. The authors of the Magna Carta couldn't possibly have intended it to protect their right to trial by jury, because no such system existed at the time. Jurors at the time were something akin to witnesses in a trial, not finders of fact as they are now. Lawful judgment of his peers didn't mean trial by jury, which anyway didn't begin to develop until 1581. But the phrase, like the other killer soundbites of Chapter 29, caught on with enough force to make any living spin doctor snap his BlackBerry in envy. Australian courts from 19th century onward routinely assumed that the Magna Carta was the source of the common law right to trial by jury. High Court judges have gone out of their way since to point out that this is legally and historically inaccurate. The phrase, "we will not deny or defer to any man either justice or right," similarly instigated a belief that the Magna Carta protected a right to a speedy trial. The emergence of this line of reasoning demonstrates the dangers of reading too literally into the Magna Carta. Beginning in the 1980s, a series of Australian judicial decisions favoured the view that the Magna Carta protected a right to a speedy trial. The High Court took 7 years, a blip in the lifetime of the Great Charter, to squash the argument. Not only did the Magna Carta not protect such a right, no such right exists at all. Due process of law, also erroneously attributed to the Magna Carta, was not a legal expression until 1354. The phrase actually used in Chapter 29, by the law of the land, doesn't mean the same thing as due process, the doctrine we rely upon today, which holds that legal proceedings must be fair and objective. Statutes written in the 14th century initiated the transformation of the former meaning to the latter. And a good thing too, because when the words were written, the law of the land included trial by ordeal, such as drowning or burning, and widespread use of judicial torture. Of course, the Magna Carta is an important part of the heritage of due process and the other common law rights that I've just described. It expressed some of the norms and values which coalesced and were developed by later legislators into a substantive system of individual rights and rules of state. Interestingly, if the people most inclined to read our Constitution as if its meaning were fixed at the point that it was written, who tend to find the most contemporary meaning in the Magna Carta rather than seeing it too as a document of its time. The true value of the Magna Carta, then, is not that it established specific rights or liberties, or even that it effectively tamed the power of the executive. Oliver Cromwell called it the Magna Fata and acted accordingly. The true value of the Magna Carta is that it imparted the declaratory tradition of public rights on which we modelled many of the most profound and important legal documents that now make up the structure of our public law. The Magna Carta represented the first great step towards a new political theory of state. That theory, when it eventually developed, was the rule of law. Inherent in that notion is a relationship between the state and the citizenry, in which the state is accountable under the law and the law is fair. Citizens in such a system are entitled to know and demand their rights. If we look around, we see that the charters which set down rights and liberties in the Western world and elsewhere are inspired by the Magna Carta. They declare and define the rights of citizens which must be respected by the state. The content of those rights has changed. The animating spirit has not. H.G. Wells, arguing forcefully during the Second World War that human rights must take a central role in Allied aims, wrote that the Magna Carta began a custom of producing, in times of turmoil, declarations of the fundamental organising principles of our society. The Petition of Right in 1628 continued this practice. So too the English Bill of Rights in 1689, the American Declaration of Independence and the French Declaration of the Rights of Man all carried on this tradition of stating the people's will. H.G. Wells correctly perceived that the turmoil of World War II compelled another such statement. It emerged 2 years after the end of the war, entitled the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Eleanor Roosevelt, the chair of the Human Rights Commission which wrote it, said that it was a declaration of basic principles to serve as a common standard for all nations and thus might well become a Magna Carta for all men everywhere. The Magna Carta was written in a world, however, in which the language of rights was at least 400 years away, and yet as a symbol of the rule of law, it has come to stand for the protection of rights and freedoms. It was, for example, invoked in the passing of the United Kingdom's Human Rights Act, even though the drafters of the Charter could not have in their wildest dreams contemplated the human rights therein. Because of its luminosity as a symbol, the Magna Carta is invoked often by litigants in the courts in a bid to protect what they believe are their rights. Almost always these are self-represented litigants who are drawn to the Magna Carta precisely because it is a symbol, a presence in the popular understanding of the law, and has, unlike the specific and technical statutes, which are very difficult to penetrate for a layman, no fixed meaning. These unfailingly unsuccessful litigants have left us a treasure of legal precedent. And so, the common law states definitively that costs orders against unsuccessful parties do not amount to selling justice, contrary to Chapter 29. The Commonwealth of Australia is competent to manufacture banknotes, even though only gold and silver coins were provided for in the Magna Carta. Our system of taxation is legal and does not involve the seizure of property contrary to the Magna Carta. Unfortunately, it's not just cranks who've come to see the Magna Carta as a supreme document which has legal effect through the ages, rather than the rudimentary but symbolic document that it was. When parliamentarians cite the Magna Carta as the basis of Australia's system of taxation, marshal it in support of free speech, or call it an actual constitutional document that guarantees, for some reason, that admission to Parliament shall be free, Mr. Ma, Member for Lowe, 1983, amongst many other what could be called ambitious and creative interpretations, it becomes easy to see how members of the public could reasonably form the view that the Magna Carta is the effective source of their contemporary rights and freedoms. But members of Parliament are a wilier bunch, at least in this respect. Whatever lofty words they may speak about the Magna Carta, they, like judges, adopt the true leaders of the law when making their decisions. And so, debating the Wartime Precautions Bill in 1915, Parliament was reminded that the safety of the country is infinitely more precious than empty talk about habeas corpus or the Bill of Rights or the Magna Carta. That act, by the way, was passed, enormously and permanently widening the powers of the federal government. So the great symbolism of the Magna Carta offers no defence to those vital principles for which, whether by myth or reality, it is said to stand. Rather, the symbol of the Magna Carta, incorrectly raised to constitutional status, overburdened with the freedoms and rights which it is said to protect, becomes a stumbling block. Attributing our rule of law and the rights that go with it to the Magna Carta, an ancient document, undersells the complex and sophisticated human rights framework which we enjoy in this country, and the arduous and contentious process by which those rights were won. More dangerously, this conception of the Magna Carta as supreme law contributes to an already complacent attitude that Australians have towards their liberties. The definition and exercise of rights is an ongoing process in a society and is capable of progress as well as regression. If we believe that the Magna Carta forever trumps other laws as the source of fundamental rights, we see that process wrongly as frozen. We're less alert to incursions on the rights that we imagine are guaranteed by the Magna Carta. In fact, they're not. Most, if not all, of the rights made famous by the Magna Carta have been subject to encroachments by Parliament. Habeas corpus is abrogated by various preventative detention laws, such as federal legislation permitting a person to be detained for up to 2 weeks without charge in relation to terrorist activity, the indefinite detention of asylum seekers with and without adverse security assessments, without meaningful access to legal advice or judicial review, offends not only habeas corpus, but the Magna Carta's enjoinder that every person is entitled to the judgment under the law of the land. Trial by jury has been dispensed with for a whole class of offences, being summary offences. Retrospective legislation, long considered offensive to Chapter 29's requirement that a person be judged according to the law of the land, has been passed by Parliament and approved by the courts. Due process gets a regular shakedown, most recently in the proposal that the immigration minister should be given the power to revoke the citizenship of Australians he suspects are involved in overseas terrorist activity. If that law fails, and there's a good chance that it will not be by the power of the Magna Carta, but by the features of our constitution, which separates the judicial power to determine guilt from the executive power to carry out the law. In our constitution, we can see refracted the long history and evolution of the Magna Carta. From it, we've inherited a legacy of rights, liberty, and rule of law. The tools that we use in the service of that legacy are modern, and as are the problems to which we bring them. The Magna Carta is an idea now, and its only strength is that of an idea, not a law. It protects us only so long as we respect its wisdom.
So now, Tim Wilson, the Human Rights Commissioner. Thank you.
I'm not going to start until everybody at the front has sat down. Well, thank you very much, Jared, for that very kind introduction, and also to my other panellists, thank you very much for your contributions this evening. It is actually a great pleasure to be here and to talk to the Sydney Institute again, particularly about the enduring relevance of Magna Carta. And I'm acutely aware of the fact that the previous panellists have both talked about its wonder and its shortcomings, but, you know, I am a bit of a romantic in some of these issues, and yes, it's symbolic, and yes, it's an idea, but it's still a symbolic and powerful idea, and I don't think we should lose sight of that while recognising that it has limitations. Because Magna Carta, of course, established a number of very important, recognised a very important number, important political principles that framed and informed our discussion around the evolution of rights and systems of governance in our country and in other countries, notably England, in the centuries that followed Magna Carta after 1215. And there are three ones I'm going to talk about very briefly, and then some more specific points I'm going to talk about. The first is government by consent. First and foremost, Magna Carta was a tax revolt. Magna Carta was, of course, signed by the king at the demand of the barons after they secured in part a common council that would give voice to the tax on taxation matters. Then there was the issue of rule of law, which, of course, some people have talked about already, and, of course, wasn't formally mentioned until the 1297 edition, which is on display in the federal parliament, and really started the evolution of the idea that everybody should be bound by the law, and, of course, the king should be bound by the law as well. The other one is justice, and Magna Carta confirmed that a system or a spirit of a justice system where people could not be arbitrarily detained without charge, and we had the follow-through of codification of basic principles of people's capacity to be heard before a court. Now, I was going to make some cursory remarks about the fact that most people who talk about the Magna Carta talk about it from a legal standpoint, or they talk about it from a political standpoint, but actually, of course, it was a very important economic document. But then I read Hugh's essay in the Australian Financial Review on Friday and thought he'd be covering the subject, so I won't contribute to that, so I had to start all over again. Where I'm going to come from is really the contribution of the Magna Carta for the development of political institutions that work towards the preservation of our freedom and our individual liberties. If you ever want, as an adult, something very entertaining to do, I recommend going and watching Disney's adaptation of Robin Hood, not the one with Kevin Costner, but the cartoon version, which I watched about 30 years ago. And recently I re-watched it for a bit of entertainment. And it is actually a very, although not factually accurate, of course, representation of the times of 1215. It does give you an insight into the perceptions or the values about why people thought it was appropriate to rise up against the king, although in that particular version it's called Prince John, not King John. And one of my favourite quotes is when Prince John the Lion is talking to Sir Hiss, who is a snake, who is his sort of servant. Prince John says, "Taxes, taxes, beautiful, wonderful taxes." And then Sir Hiss makes a cursory remark about the injustice of it all. And Prince John says, "To coin a phrase, rob the poor to feed the rich." And that is the spirit in which he was trying to present it. And it's actually a fascinating movie because it actually teaches children, among other things, that excessive taxation is in fact unjust, which is pretty rare for a kids' movie, you have to say. But, of course, taxes played an enormously important part of the evolution of Magna Carta. It wasn't the only one, but it was a very important one. The first clause in Magna Carta was about the English Church and that it shall be free and shall have its rights undiminished and its liberties unimpaired. While an underlying factor of the inclusion of this clause related to things like religious freedom, it was also about who had the opportunity to enjoy the revenues of the Church. As Danny DeZiga and John Gilliam wrote in the book that was mentioned before, 1215, the year of Magna Carta, the church's annual income at the time was estimated to be around £80,000, and that's in 1215 dollars. As a king desperate for revenue, John regularly sought to pillage the revenues of the church. He did so by requiring that positions within the church be selected from his candidates, and there was normally only one candidate he put forward, and then denying the church the capacity to have a candidate. So while those positions within the church sat vacant, the crown collected a church's revenues during the period of the vacancy. Not surprisingly, there was a tendency by the king for vacancies to be prolonged. Starving the church of funds was, of course, deeply unpopular within the institution, but also directly threatened its autonomy. It's for this reason, of course, among others, the churches strongly supported the barons, who shared similar concerns around being tired of paying taxes being imposed by the king to fight failed wars. Clause 12 of Magna Carta read that no scutage or aid is to be levied in our realm except by the Common Council. The essential principle that we can draw from it was that taxes could not be levied without a degree of consent. And I think this is a fundamentally important point, because in practice the Common Council really started the evolution of the broad idea of a separation of powers in terms of an institutional capacity. I recognise that there's a dispute about when the evolution of modern democracy started, but as a forerunner for the discussion of division of powers, I think it's important. The relatively simple contribution of Magna Carta, of course, currently lives on, but I would argue is currently being compromised. It is certainly true that today in Australia we are taxed by consent. Parliaments, at least in principle, represent contemporary will. But the problem is that the federal parliament doesn't just impose taxes for today. By continuing to run up year-on-year deficits and ever accumulating debt, the principle of taxation by consent is broken. Recent governments have consistently spent more than the tax revenue they have raised. Now, of course, not all debt is bad. Debts that reflect the long-term cost of infrastructure enjoyed across generations is entirely legitimate, but that is not always the nature of debt that is accumulated today. Contemporary debt is accumulated to finance lifestyles of today. Those who benefit are, of course, consenting to that consumption. But the cost is being passed on to future generations who are bound to repay it. Intergenerational debt can be taxation without consent. When one generation inherits burdensome debt without consent, their freedom is ultimately curtailed because their fate is in part bound until it is repaid. Parliaments that accumulate intergenerational debt without any intergenerational dividend are, I think, breaking a foundational principle of Magna Carta by going through that process of acquiring people's energies and labour into the future. Another enduring legacy of Magna Carta is that important respect for different institutions of government to fulfil their roles. Now, that is a spirit rather than an explicit statement in terms of the actual structure. Of course, Magna Carta recognised that there was a king and that they operated broadly under the law, that there would be a common council that would deal with certain matters, that the role of the courts, as they were, could be arbiters of what they considered at the time, and we've already heard about the challenges of trial by ordeal, a form of justice. These bodies, of course, enlarged freedom to the extent that they could by dividing a concentration of power. Following on from Magna Carta, both English and American societies continue to develop the ideas that rights and freedoms were best preserved through the division of power. The importance of the separation of powers is greater than institutional independence. It is also about respecting that decisions are coupled with the information of those it affects. The independence of the modern incarnation of these institutions are respected by Magna Carta through the modern democracy that we live in. The Parliament, of course, designs laws and regulations that create the framework to preserve and protect our rights and enlarge our freedoms, reflecting the public's will. The executive, in principle, operationalises the day-to-day business of government with a mixture of appropriate knowledge about individuals tempered by those society-wide expectations. The role of the courts is, of course, to interpret laws and regulations and impose penalties for breaches of those laws with appropriate knowledge about individuals and their cases. My view is when one arm of government starts to involve itself in the other, it compromises this institutional structure and its capacity to preserve and defend rights. These compromises occur when the Parliament seeks to bind the hands of the judiciary by introducing mandatory sentencing, even though they lack the information of the individual cases. So too, compromises also arise when people argue to circumvent parliamentary sovereignty through what we call the modern concept of charters of rights. The central argument behind a charter of rights is that it can be used by the courts to interpret laws mindful of rights established by the political will. That assumes, of course, that doesn't already occur. Of course, we know that is in large part what the common law does in informing these sorts of decisions. The common law primarily, though, focuses on individual negative rights. And by negative rights, I mean the right of individual against state power that defer to greater liberty of the individual. Depending on their design, of course, charters of rights often include both negative rights and positive rights that focuses on the expectation from government, such as, say, for instance, issues around access to health services. Yet where judges begin deliberating on matters of rights that go beyond being interpreters of law to arbiters of public policy. That is particularly true when they consider issues like positive rights. When a court makes a decision on a positive right, it is afforded the power to make decisions on issues without the comparable knowledge or responsibility of their decisions, notably the financial costs it may impose on the state and then, as an extension, the taxpayer. Courts are not the place to fight out these issues of legitimate public policy. That rightly sits with the Parliament. When the Parliament develops charters of rights and handballs decisions to the courts, they're undermining the very institution that they serve. In practice, that means taking power not just away from the Parliament, but also the people. So if the people do not value human rights, it is a failure of education, and that is where our efforts should be put. To play its part, next Monday, the Commission will be releasing its education resources for schools on the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta and how it did start a domino effect through to the modern thinking and values of human rights, which, as was perfectly explained before, led in part to the evolution of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Improving the standing and respect for rights requires improving public understanding about their value and their place in modern society, particularly in times of conflict and particularly in times when they become threatened or people seek security over liberty. Often it's those times we have to defend them most strongly. Australians in particular value human rights, but not in isolation. We value rights when they are nested with other values such as fairness, justice and responsibility. Now thankfully Australians have rarely had to struggle for their rights, as the traditions that evolved, and particularly out of English law, but also out of the evolution of the American tradition, we inherited them. These traditions underpin the values that we continue to enjoy, the rights we continue to enjoy. The preservation of these structures is very important, though, to make sure that we preserve our rights, and they are always under threat. Defending democracy, rights and freedom from even well-intended politicians requires eternal vigilance. Vigilance is particularly necessary when it involves fighting unpopular causes, including opposition to media regulation, insufficient safeguards on the 2-year retention of data, or stripping away the citizenship rights of foreign fighters. And on the latter point, I sympathise, of course, with the government's overall objective about finding ways to tackle this significant challenge. But I do raise concern about the method and the consequences that has for the structures of our democracy, because I don't think that of all the issues that have been raised to date, the following questions have been satisfactorily clarified at this stage, such as why Australian-born citizens who are dual nationals should be stripped of their citizenship, or why Australian sole citizens could be stripped of their citizenship and how that could be done without rendering people stateless. Why executive government should decide whether a person's citizenship is removed on the basis of the mere suspicion of terrorism and not the courts. These issues, of course, should be addressed before Parliament make any decision about them, because a person's citizenship is very much the basis of other rights that we enjoy. We should treat any attempt to remove a person's citizenship with extreme caution. Preserving rights and freedoms is rarely as we would like it to be. We are ordinarily only called in to defend them for undesirable people and at undesirable times. Yet the legacy of Magna Carta is the constant discussion and debate around these very important principles, particularly underpinned by the structures of our system of government, to preserve and protect them at some of the most difficult times in English history, American history, and our history. 800 years on, that challenge still faces us. Thank you.
Well, many thanks to Hugh Harley, Andy Pachansky, and Tim Wilson. They've all kept to their time limit, so we've got time for
debate and discussion. So what I think I'll do is ask all three of you to stand up here. I'm going to disappear in a minute, so if you'll come up here and we'll take questions from the floor. But I'll lead off. Can I just take you, thanks for three very good papers, can I just take you back to 1215? England then, 800 years ago, was essentially, insofar as it was religious, it was a Catholic society. It was 300 years before the Reformation. It took the Vatican about until the mid-20th century to recognise the importance of democracy. But obviously the Catholic Church in England 300 years before the Reformation was going along with Magna Carta and was against the king and with the barons. So how did the, I mean, some of you have mentioned this, but how did the, this was essentially a religious society at the time. How did that all fit into it all? Now, any of you can take that. Let us come up here, and who wants to go up on that? Hugh. Okay, let's start with Hugh, and then Andrew, if you come up here, and Tim, you come up here.
Yeah. So, I mean, not for the first time in history, the church wasn't necessarily as one. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury had a fundamental role in conceiving and effectively agreeing the Magna Carta. On the other hand, it was only effectively as soon as King John signed it, he breathed a sigh of relief, and then wrote to the Pope asking him to annul it, and the Pope, of course, happily obliged to that. So, you know, the conclusion is that clearly neither the King nor the Pope really thought much of the rule of law. I mean, that's really the bottom line. Effectively, that was the trigger then that cast England into a civil war, which ran. Involved King John. King John effectively died on the, not actually on the battlefield, but you know, trying to escape his pursuers, and that's what led William Marshall to the regency. And as I've tried to explain, that was then a decisive point. But interestingly, of course, William Marshall was against it and then became for it.
Anyone else want to make a comment on that? Alice Grundy.
I have a question for Hugh, following on from Anya's comments about the way that the people who wrote the Magna Carta could in no way conceive of how it would be interpreted over time. I was wondering if you had any comments about the way the authors saw the document and what they anticipated for it.
So for those who are picking up, how did the authors see the document and what did they anticipate?
Sure. I mean, at the end of the day, it was designed to be a peace treaty, right? You know, it was the barons trying to have their specific grievances heard, and in many ways they walked away from it just as quickly as the king did as well. That's one of the ironies, and that's why England went into civil war pretty quickly. I mean, look, I agree entirely with Daniel's point that from today's point of view, you know, that clearly no one in 1215 could have anticipated the sorts of challenges of today, nor should we see it as any more in legal sense now than a symbol, but to pick up Tim's point, an incredibly important symbol. And you know, again, I agree entirely that it was Cromwell who called it the Magna Carta. You know, the point is that it was in exactly the same era or just before that the great jurist Coke had used it critically. You know, at the time where Charles and James, the kings, were trying to pursue the divine right of kings, he used it fundamentally and frankly, as much as a document of symbolism as anything else. So, you know, I mean, today it's clearly a symbol, but it's had, in my mind, it's had legal relevance at critical junctures in history.
Either of you want to make a point about that? Anya, Tim?
I don't have much to add. I completely agree with everything that's just been said, but I think in the end, as a political philosophical context, what it really did was entrench the idea over time of this idea of individuals sort of having rights. And yes, it took time over to evolve, but particularly with this tension in the 17th century with relation to whether England had this sort of ancient constitution that was secured by principles under Magna Carta, or whether you took a more Lockean approach which evolved about natural rights of people. In the end, it was that sort of philosophical concept about the relationship to the individual, which does have some legacy in terms of Magna Carta, but that's a political philosophy observation, not a legal observation.
Cook is one of the reasons why perhaps the Magna Carta had such an unforeseen...
Which Cook are we talking about?
The jurist. Yes. Who, perhaps one of the reasons why it had such an unforeseen effect, because, and as he's been in a lot of academic trouble for the last 100 or so years, he put it to use and gave it an interpretation that textually... it's now argued isn't sound, and he really interpreted much more out of it than had been used previously.
Yeah, and I mean, just can I just finish on it because it's interesting. I think this is fascinating. Just one footnote. It wasn't until Blackstone's work in sort of the 1860s that actually people realised there'd been the three different editions. As far as of 1215, 1216, 1217, Coke was operating from the 1225 version. I mean, again, it's just a footnote in terms of how much more historical detail we've got on this in the last 100 years or so.
Okay, we've got a question here, then we go down the back, yeah?
Tim, you've placed great emphasis on the principle of government by consent as a legacy of Magna Carta. But don't you think that institutions, supranational institutions like the Human Rights Commission, as well as judicial activism, have today placed a great threat on the idea of government by consent?
The suggestion that judicial activism and the Human Rights Commission...
Well, the Human Rights threatens democracy. I'm not sure the Human Rights Commission quite threatens democracy. It's a government body. I mean, I think if you're talking more about the United Nations, is that where your comments...
Exactly.
International
yes.
bodies, when you say supranational bodies. And yes, that's part of the great challenge and test, because the evolution of the idea of sort of international law and that can be imposed and the extent to which that can have influence does have a direct threat on sovereignty. And we see this both in terms of political arguments as well as in terms of law. But the extent to which countries still preserve their sovereignty based on their interests. So the Human Rights Commission doesn't have the power to do that, so we're not included in that juncture. But are there threats to sovereignty? Of course, always. But government by consent, that's why I raised that point, particularly with relation to charters of rights. I have issues about that because I think it does, one, raise issues about government and consent and who's making decisions, but also the point I raised about taxation by consent, because if you go back to that sort of symbolic value of the social contract between generations, you know, you can't dispute the fact that I think that is under serious test.
There's a question down there. Yeah, Tony. Yeah, just come back here.
Could that be linked in actual fact to an attempt to go back? Because certainly there was a separation of powers in Athenian society a long time before, and in Roman society, you know, where...
Yeah,
okay, just a second. Were the Magna Carta people trying to go back to the separation of powers that existed earlier in other societies.
Yeah. And that's why, if you look at it, I always use the word modern, which is the evolution essentially of the English tradition, because, you know, the very idea of democracy didn't start with whichever point or reference point you use in England and throughout the from the 1200s onwards. So that's why I use the word modern.
Okay. Now, it's right down the back, yeah. This
yes,
one of
I guess this is me. Mainly for Anya. Would you say it's accurate to say that the Magna Carta Section 29, originally Section 39, if I'm not mistaken, at least began either a precedent and or an organic legal evolution that the king, queen, could no longer personally, on a point of absolute power, personally determine criminal guilt before and under the law? For example, by the early 1930s, King George V couldn't use his reserved powers to personally, arbitrarily determine the law. by himself.
Yep.
So the question about the Magna Carta as a precedent for stopping the monarch from determining guilt.
Yes, I think it was a very important point in the development of that system, but it can't be taken alone, because by the time the Magna Carta was written, there was already a system of courts, of the king's courts that travelled around the country, and largely issues of liability and guilt were determined by those courts. The king could still intervene. And the Magna Carta did attempt to restrict that right, but future monarchs didn't necessarily abide by that promise themselves. But it was a very important point in demarcating the line of power.
Okay. Does anyone else want to comment on that? You don't. Okay. Now, there's a question over here.
Yes. The current problem for our government, of course, the question of state, making people stateless, but it's also a question of treason. Did Magna Carta say anything about treason?
So it's a point leading on from the discussion about citizenship to the concept of treason. The question is, did the Magna Carta look at the issue of treason?
It was...
Tim.
I'm trying to remember the words and make myself sound really impressive, but I can't. But there's something with relation to exile, that you can't be made... You can't be exiled except by the common law of the land.
That's 39.
So. That's right, yeah. And so, but it still was only on the basis of law, so it could be done, but it had to be done on the basis of law.
You do want to add to that?
No, we'll come back here.
Okay, you're done. All right, stay there. Don't all keep running away from me, because it looks like there's nobody here. Come back here. Hang on, we're going here. Okay.
My question is for you, because of the history of the period. I understood at the time of King John there was less anti-Semitism in England than the continent perhaps. There was a change. Did this influence, was that true, or did that influence the development of English society?
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting point, actually. In about the 1170s, there was quite a big immigration of Jewish people from the continent into the UK, or into England, sorry, of course. And associated with that was actually quite a substantial growth in credit for the first time, and that was another one of the drivers for the economic growth of the time. Likewise, it was clearly a source of some considerable concern. And if you look to the 1215 version of the Magna Carta, very early in the piece, I mean, as Tim said, number one is the church. And you may have made the same point as well. But then by the time you get to 5, 6, 7 of the 63 clauses, it's all about the question of debt and debt to Jews and debt forgiveness and widows and all sorts of things. So it was clearly a critical issue of the time, and one that the Magna Carta was designed to be very specific to resolve. What's interesting is that you fast forward until 1290, and that's when the Jews were expelled from England. So effectively, and that wasn't reversed, I think, until 1674. So again, if you look at the big picture here, stepping right back, and this comes back to the point about the Catholic Church. From the early thousands, you know, 1000 AD, the church became much more liberal than it had been, and actually tried to marry religious thought and reason to try to understand how the world was operating. And I think that actually was decisive in lots of the developments that we saw in the UK. I mean, why, for instance, Henry I wanted to have a much more fact-based approach to managing the finances. The Exchequer dates from there. It's why Henry II wanted the system of common law. So, and that whole influence lasted right up until about 1275. Now, I can't remember the name of the Pope, but effectively, particularly around the work of Roger Bacon, you regard as the first experimental scientist based in Oxford, but because of his work and others, the church started getting very nervous and basically pulled the shutters right down from about 1275. And that was effectively the end of that liberal era that had lasted for a couple of hundred years and didn't reopen again until effectively the Reformation. So I think historically part of the reason we struggle to understand that period of Magna Carta as such a relatively liberal and prosperous and effectively growing economy is because, you know, our picture of the Middle Ages is much more around the plague and around a restrictive and actually a pretty corrupt church. There's no doubt the expulsion of the Jews in 1290 pulled back the credit lever and actually was another factor restricting growth.
Anyone else? Sorry.
So no, that's. Let me end there.
Anyone else? All right. So where? There's a question here. Yeah.
In relation to ministerial power, what about the proposition that the minister is accountable to the people every 3 years, whereas the courts are not accountable to the people every 3 years?
The suggestion is the minister of a government is accountable to the people every, say, 3 years. The courts are not accountable to the people at all.
Correct. And the minister is also accountable to Parliament. That is also a very important part of the proposition as well. Nobody's disputing that. The question really, and this is why I raise questions rather than answers, is what is the extent to which the executive can make a decision, not only be part of the Parliament that designs laws, but then seek to essentially enforce them and make these decisions on the removal of citizenship. I'm waiting to hear convincing answers on these issues, particularly because they directly relate to people's rights. And I use very specific examples with relation to dual nationals and who have Australian-born as well as sole nationals, because those issues have not been properly addressed. But yes, is the minister accountable to Parliament? Sure. Is he in this case, responsible to the people? Yes, as well. And that's important, but the point of courts and having a separation of powers is there is supposed to be a division between those who write the laws and those who seek to interpret them and impose penalties.
But his point is that the courts aren't responsible to anyone, I think.
Well, the courts aren't responsible to anybody in the extent that they make these decisions. They're appointed by a government, we know that, and that's part of the benefit of the system.
Not like in America.
You want elected judges?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, all right. Well, I don't think that proposal's on the table at the moment. I'm not 100% sure I'd be convinced that I can see the merit of it, though. But
anyone else want to add to that?
I mean, arguably, judges are accountable to the judges of higher courts, and nobody's going to elect the members of our high court anytime soon, even if we did have elected magistrates. So there is a very strong system of accountability. It's just not through votes.
Yeah, I'd also argue that the traditions of the common law system's critical in this. I mean, the system that has been built up is one where the judges are not exclusively bound by precedent, but there's certainly a sense in which they're guided by precedent. And I think, you know, precisely why, in my mind, this 800th anniversary is so important, because it's actually allowing us to reflect on, you know, an extraordinary system that's built up over such a long period of time, and, you know, in the sweep of history, probably served us pretty damn well.
Now we're getting to the end. Have I missed anyone? There's a question here.
Yes, look, just one quick one, and I'm sorry I forget to mention it, but it was actually mentioned that in 1915 there was some thought, I guess because of world situations and times, that, did I get it right, that there was some thought that there should be other ways of perhaps looking at some of the rights and laws at the time. Was that?
Yep. Mr. Chansky mentioned the 1915 War Regulations Act.
The wartime precautions.
Wartime precautions.
Then you'd like to
check. In sort of current times as we see them now, we have some pretty important situations going on worldwide now. So as far as rights
are
concerned.
Take us back to 1915. That was a 700th anniversary, wasn't it?
There you go. I mean, the rights that were under discussion in the quote that I made, that habeas corpus, the Bill of Rights, and the Magna Carta, weren't you know, overlooked or appealed by that bill. That bill simply infringed upon them, and that's been, like many other national security forms of national security legislation, like the other contemporary law that I mentioned that allows detention of a somebody on based on terrorist activity for 2 weeks without charge. They do infringe upon these basic common law rights. That's normally seen as a negative thing, because continued infringement on those rights erodes them, and arguably the, you know, as it's said, like the point of fighting World War One or Two or fighting against terrorists is to preserve our system of government, the inherent characteristic of which is to preserve our system of rights. And when you start delineating between people within a society who do deserve the rights and people who don't, you know, baddies and goodies, the lines blur, and people inevitably, innocent people, end up having their rights revoked or abrogated because the system no longer guarantees rights for everybody.
Just a final question to all three of you. Let's start in reverse order with Tim. I mean, what's all this Magna Carta thing all about? I went through law school a long time ago. I don't recall anyone talking much about it. It seems to have suddenly blossomed in the last 10 or even 5 years, and we're all sort of into Magna Carta. Is it just the centenary coming around yet again, or is there some other reason why we're now talking about it much more than I think we were 50 or 100 years ago?
I'm not 100% sure of the answer, but one of the things I would say is that it always does become popular when people see infringements on liberties. That's one of the reasons why, you know, Coke raised it so strongly in the 1700s, and maybe as much as anything else, the issues around counter-terrorism and dealing with the issues of foreign conflicts overseas and the extent to which we suppress liberties as part of that discussion is a key driver behind why it attaches a new romantic ideal in a country such as ours, because people are looking back at what the origins of these principles are and then seeing whether they align with what is modern practice. And of course, we are on this continual evolution and this continual process of discovering and rediscovering. I suspect that's probably a part of it. But the fact that we're talking about it this week happens to be because it's the 800th anniversary, Jared. I can say that with confidence.
Aren't you?
I think that there has been a renewed, if not renewed, but even the beginning of a new type of a debate about rights and liberties from the time of the Second World War onwards. There's been the emergence of all kinds of notions about rights and liberties that never existed before, and, you know, something which I think Tim's view illustrates some of the distinctions in as well. The idea of social and economic rights, rights to social welfare, these things weren't conceived of until the 50s, 60s and 70s. And so we're having a very different and a much more energised debate about what rights are, and people are looking for touchstones. And in a common law system, it's natural that people reach into the past to look at precedent.
Hugh, final comment.
I think there are two things. I think one, there has actually been a huge amount of medieval scholarship in the last 30 years or so, which has come together, and I think that that's painted a much richer picture of how the world of the 1200s was. And I think the second thing, to echo, you know, both my co-panelists, is Blind Freddy can see that we're living through extraordinary times, and the, you know, I really do believe that the changes we're going through now are every bit as profound as the changes of the 1700s and 1800s, and they're going to be every bit as profound for the impact of our institutional frameworks. And you know, I think that history can absolutely be our friend in this, and I think, frankly, it's behoven on all of us who really do believe in the importance of liberty in the broader sense to participate in the debate and understand it. So, you know, thank you all for coming to listen to the three of us.
It's been a very lively discussion tonight. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure we all have. I should say thanks to Hugh Harley, who gave us the idea of putting this on.
to Anya Potansky and to Tim Wilson for all three for very lively presentations, and we'll publish them in due course. And so it's happy birthday to Magna Carta next Monday, but we got in first. Well, ahead of Q&A, I have to say. Okay.
Thanks, folks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.